If you look at the first few verses of 1 John, like, for example, the epistles of Paul, he does not name himself, does not spend any time with greetings at all. He just immediately in his introductory verses gets to the point. He kind of establishes the thesis of the entirety of the book, and that basically is that our fellowship is in Christ Jesus, and what we have is accomplished through Him. We'll look at that as we get into the verse study in just a little while. But as such, there is no acknowledgement or note that He is the writer of the epistle. So we ask the question, how do we know that John wrote the text or wrote the letter? Well, individuals who would know that John wrote it said that he wrote it. And it's interesting that as you go back and seek to find corroborative evidence with regard to the various books written, who they were attributed to, when the attribution was given and such, that there's very few books that have a greater witness in that regard than John. I just mentioned one example, or actually it's two examples, but in the second bullet under authorship, that John had, of course, many who sat at his feet to hear his teaching. And two of his direct students, individuals that lived their lives, younger than him, but lived their lives concurrent with John's, are named Polycarp and Papias, two individuals who themselves wrote. We commonly refer to these extra-biblical writings that are pretty ancient, talking about the first couple of centuries, as being the church fathers. And a further designation is the early church fathers or late church fathers. And this would be the early church fathers, among the first extra-biblical writings that we have. And both of these individuals quoted from this epistle and attributed to their teacher, John. And there is reference to John as being the writer of the epistle, possibly within 20 years of the writing of the epistle itself. Now, I would just kind of like you to consider that with regard to a generation. If I were, for example, to have a letter that was written by my father or my grandfather, and I quote from that letter and attribute it to my father or grandfather because I had that knowledge of it, that's the kind of evidence that we have that the one who wrote this book indeed was John. Again, we do argue, and we've made this argument at the beginning of each of our books that we've studied, that as conservative Christians, we can have confidence due to God's providence and His desire that we know His will, that what is claimed concerning these scriptures is in actuality. So, I believe that to be the case. I recognize that that's not an argument that will hold a great deal of water with a skeptic, but I just want you to acknowledge if we accept a couple of suppositions, first of all, that God exists, which, again, when we suppose these things, I think there's evidence to support them, but nevertheless, we work from that basic approach that God exists and that He has revealed Himself to us, and thirdly, that He desires for us to know His will. Then when we begin to talk about the preservation of that will, the fact that it's accurate for us today, that we can know what His will is, know what constitutes His will, have confidence in those kinds of things, I think that that is sure, and we can be certain. So, having said that, while there are other books that skeptics will indeed cast aspersion upon with regard to them actually being written by whom, by the one who claims to be the writer, or that by the one who is traditionally accepted as being the writer, that's really not the case with this particular epistle. It is widely understood and recognized that John, the Apostle John, was the writer of that epistle. So those witnesses are in almost total agreement, and so we can be confident that John is indeed the one who wrote this particular book. Now, with that in mind, let's talk for just a few moments about John the Apostle. It's interesting as you And we could spend, you know, several weeks just going through all the references to John. That's not, of course, the purpose, as we're wanting to study his epistle rather than himself. But he is one of the significant characters in the New Testament, not only because of the writings of John. John's writings are second only to Paul's writings with regard to extent. You look at what he wrote. He wrote both the three epistles, as well as the Gospel of John, as well as the Revelation. And if you'll notice there under John the Apostle, the third and final bullet, I'm not kind of missing the one in order, but the point is that if you were to take just with regard to words, he wrote fully 20% of the New Testament. His writings with regard to the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. 2nd and 3rd John, of course, are very short epistles. This epistle is a bit longer, 5 chapters in extent. And then the book of Revelation. So, with regard to these things, we have quite extensive writings where we can know something of his personality and something of his nature, as well as the biography of John as it is revealed in the Gospels and in the book of Acts. So there is much that is known of him. Of course, James was his brother. They were referred to as sons of Zebedee, referred to as sons of thunder. And there is some indication in Scripture that John and James were men of great temper and rashness. We, of course, see some of that with regard to Peter as well. These are individuals who were untrained, referred to as ignorant men, because they did not have the classical education that others had at that particular time. In fact, if you'll go just very quickly to Acts chapter 4, we'll make reference to that passage very quickly. When we find after the death of Jesus, the beginnings of the persecution of people of God, which led to, you'll remember in the 8th chapter, the dispersion of Christians from Jerusalem throughout the world at that time, Judea and Samaria. But here in this particular occasion, the apostles were speaking to the people, and as a result of that, we are told in verse 1 that the priests, the captain of the temple, the Sadducees came upon them, and being greatly disturbed, that they taught the people and preached in Jesus the resurrection from the dead, they laid hands on them and put them into custody until the next day, for it was already evening. That was Peter and John who were arrested in that particular on that particular occasion. And so these individuals, Peter is given the lead in verse 8 of the text, but Peter and John, they address the Sanhedrin. And we're told in verse 13 of the text, when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated and untrained men, they marveled and realized that they had been with Jesus. And this, of course, is, I suppose, a significant text in the sense that it is that latter phrase, noted that they had been with Jesus, which is what gave the apostles the authority that they had in the first century. And one of the things to keep in mind, and it actually is an introductory thought that he begins his epistle with, is that John was among those men who saw Jesus, who gazed upon him, who touched him, who were aware of his goings in and comings out, and all of the things that he accomplished and did in his ministry, as well as his crucifixion and resurrection from the dead. And as such, they served as ambassadors of Christ, eyewitnesses of his majesty, and were authoritative in the testimony that they gave concerning the resurrected Christ and that he was the anointed of God and the Savior of the world. So there is significance in his testimony because of who he was, but more to the point of what it was that he had witnessed. And although they were not educated men, when Jesus gathered his disciples together, he didn't go for the intellectually elite of that time. He didn't go to the leaders of the people. These were simple men, fishermen, that he went to be his ambassadors and eyewitnesses of his resurrection. And John would be characteristic of that. Now, when we talk about John as a result of these things, it is kind of an interesting thing about the apostles is that not much is known about them. But Peter and John, perhaps, are the two that the most is known about. They seem to have been part of the inner circle, those who were closest to Christ, among those, for example, who witnessed his transfiguration on the Mount. And more is said about them than others. I was talking with Dennis just last week as we made reference, or I made reference in one of my lessons to Matthias, who was the man who was numbered with the 12, taking the place of Judas Iscariot. And while much is said about what went on leading up to the need for such a replacement, and he is identified as one who was with them from the beginning, nothing else is known about Matthias. And we don't hear a single word about him. And there are several of the other apostles. Very little is known about them other than the list of names that indicate that the 12 were with him from the beginning. But we do know something more of John. And we recognize him to be the man who, again, acknowledged as a man of temper, the son of thunder, was one who, when Jesus was rejected by some, was all for them being wiped off the face of the earth. And he became known as the Apostle of Love. He is referred to as the Beloved of Jesus, the one who Jesus loved. Refers to himself in that way at the Passover supper as his supper was instituted before his trip to Gethsemane. There was a great change, I think, that has wrought in his character. And the importance of that can be seen in regard to his first epistle. I think it's something that's going to be very obvious as we get into a reading of this first epistle. The transformation of John. If we were to say it as a transformation, not saying that he could not have been a loving person, but again, when you have such a paucity of information about an individual, and that's certainly the case even with Peter and John, what you can do is look at those events in their life and that are reported, and from that maybe get some indications of character. You have, for example, with Peter, an individual of great courage, but also a very brash individual that sometimes spoke before he thought, and sometimes made broad proclamations that he couldn't back up or didn't back up. And so we always talk about how rash Peter was. Well, I don't know that he particularly was a rash person, but we have examples of rashness. Examples of times in his life to where he exhibited that characteristic. And what we find with regard to John is a very loving individual. Love is expressed in the words of his gospel, and it's especially evident with regard to the tenor of the text of the epistles. Just very quickly, because it's jumping ahead a little bit, but I want you to go over to 2 John and just want you to read the first three verses with me of that epistle, where he is greeting one who is referred to as the elect or chosen lady and her children. Notice the language that he used. He says, "The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also who have known the truth, because of the truth which abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace with you from God the Father, the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, in truth and love. I rejoice greatly that I have found some of your children walking in truth." And just this this expression of love. When he gets into verse 5, he talks about the great commandment we had from the beginning, that you love one another, and the love for God that is found in keeping his commandments. In 3 John, when he talks about Gaius, as he addresses him, though he's very strong condemnation later in verses 9 and following of Diotrephes, who was an individual who was the opposite of loving. He was an individual who put individuals out of the church, was a domineering sort. But concerning Gaius, he said, "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth, beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health. And just as your soul prospers, I rejoice greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, that you walk in truth. And I have no greater joy than to hear my children walk in truth." If we were talking about love, I think in that regard, the idea is of a tenderness and a sweetness to his character and a sweetness to his writings that are especially evident in his epistles. Something to do, assuredly, with the purpose of the writings. You know, you It's one thing to write in love. I'm always reminded when people start talking about the tone of epistles and those mirroring the character of the apostles. Understand this: the apostle John could be a very unsparing and strong in his denunciation of error or of sin and of the sinner. And that scene, while he's talking about the beloved Gaius, who he loved, then he begins to talk of Diotrephes, and it's a very strong condemnation of that individual. And I'm reminded of what Jude said in Jude verse 3, when he said, "Beloved, I got it right at the tip of my tongue, and then as I quote it, I know I'll get it wrong, but his intent was to write to them concerning their common salvation." But you'll notice what he said there in verse 3, "Beloved," using that term beloved as well, "while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith." And then he spends the rest of his epistle talking about the false teachers, and it speaks in very stern and condemning, very stern tones, condemning these false teachers. It's a very strongly worded epistle of warning and condemnation of evil. But that's not what Jude wanted to do. What Jude wanted to do was write to them about their common salvation. He wanted to write a very positive epistle, write about our common faith and the love and fellowship that we enjoy. But he couldn't because of the present distress, because of the circumstances. So I think that when we talk about those things, I think that we ought to be careful and recognize that while we may have snippets of the lives of Paul and of John and Peter and such that we can look at and maybe get an insight as to the type of individuals that they were, recognize that anytime you look at snippets, you look at just snapshots of an individual's life, what you get is a very much a stereotypical view of that person. It's paper thin. It's not fully rounded. And my idea of all of the apostles is that although there are different personality traits and such, that they were well-rounded individuals. And you wouldn't want to be judged by just a few events in your life. You want to be recognized for what is the entirety of self. And we certainly should consider the apostles in that way as well. They were faithful Christians. They were good men. They were men that were handpicked by Jesus, and so they were outstanding individuals. And John certainly is an example of this. And while we may not know as much about others as we do about him, we can certainly learn from his example, and we ought to seek to emulate him and the type of individual that he was. John was an interesting fellow. The passage that there in the second bullet under John the Apostle that I made note of is Acts 8. In Acts the 8th chapter, of course, we find Peter and John together again. And on that particular occasion, it was when they were sent by the apostles to Samaria that the Samaritans, though they had responded to the preaching of Philip and been converted, the Holy Spirit had not fell upon any of them. And so Paul and Peter went down for the purpose of imparting these miraculous gifts through the laying on of their hands or imposition of their hands. And Peter and John did this together. So there's another example of some of John's work that we might allude to. Okay, so we've talked about the authorship and as well a little bit about John himself. Again, not my purpose to go into any great detail about the man or those things, because we're more interested in the epistle itself. But having said that, I don't want to go on without giving anyone an opportunity to want to add to that at all. Any comments, questions about John? Or yes, Scott?
Just a thought. We were talking about snapshots of their lives. Uh-huh. And I was thinking, if I was going to show my life, I can take pictures of my travel spot, of my travel areas. And then you would assume I'm a world traveler, and anything would be further from the truth.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Snapshots can be deceiving.
They certainly can. I just want us to recognize again that these were real men with full personalities. And again, you take as an example with regard to the Apostle Peter. Some actually cast dispersion upon Peter because of his claim that he would never deny the Lord. And then, of course, Jesus predicted that he would three times before the cock crowed at his arrest, and which happened. And we look at Peter. We look at Peter when he got out of the boat, was walking on water, but the wind was boisterous and the waves high, so he faltered and began to sink. Had to be saved by the Lord. And we talk about that brashness and that impetuous nature, but he was a man of great faith and great strength, and even within those couple of examples that I gave, there are indications of a faith that perhaps surpassed some of the others, as he at least followed behind when others had already forsaken Jesus, or he did get out of the boat when others stayed in, and he didn't. He's the only one, the one that sought to walk to Jesus. That was a great expression of faith. But we just, I think, sometimes can be guilty of making these two-dimensional characters instead of the three-dimensional people that they actually are. David, you have something?
In 2nd and 3rd John, he addresses them as the elder. Is there any indication that's an office of as an elder, or just because of age? Because this is written in AD 90, so he was up in years.
Yeah, I think that's a designation of respect. The language there in that particular text is a bit different in regard to its wording than, for example, in Peter's epistle in 1 Peter 5, where he said, "I am a fellow elder," having reference to the office of elder. Understand that the term elder is a generic term. It has reference to an older person. And in the first century, and likewise in our time as well, one who is an older person is an individual who should be given respect and who is worthy of respect. Certainly the case with regard to the apostle. I don't know that we know enough about John's life to be able to say for certainty as to whether or not, for example, he was married or if he served as an elder in the church. He was an apostle and an older man and an ambassador of Christ, so he was certainly worthy of respect. That's a phrase or a title that would be, well, a title I don't think is necessarily appropriate. It could be used in a sense of the term, but it is certainly an indication of respect because of his age. That would be my view of it. Yes, Ron? Did you have something?
I just have a question. And John and James were known as the Sons of Thunder or Sons of Boanerges.
Right.
By Jesus himself. Had he mitigated that personality from the trait of his of this time? Or was it still there, just kind of suppressed?
Well, I think that's more the fact. Again, when you look at early on in their relationship with Jesus, the indication of their being sons of thunder was something that, with regard to their personality, that they were very that they were easily roused. There were indications concerning, again, with their character, their desire that those who would stand against their master be destroyed. And the nature of Christ and his sacrifice and his purpose in coming to the earth will serve to alter any of us if we allow it, to where we become more like him. And I think certainly that all of the disciples did as they sought to emulate it. Doesn't change personality necessarily. So if you say Sons of Thunder, did he lose his fire and vigor and his zeal? Of course not. He certainly did. But I do think that it is interesting if you were to consider these young men that they came to follow Jesus, or I'm not sure about the very relative ages, but undeveloped with regard to the character that Jesus would have them be. And then you look at their writings, you see a certain modification, obvious, especially in John's writings, with regard to the emphasis and the language that he uses. He's Jesus certainly changed him. It's something that's pretty obvious. But yeah, I think probably he was still a pretty powerful personality. I would know that.
I think I see some of that in his writing about biography.
Yeah.
He said, "Look, I'll be there."
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. The audacity of Diotrephes, that's something we'll get into that when we get into 3 John. But the idea of here was an apostle of the Lord. And this man was to the point where, kind of Napoleonic in his approach to things, this is my church, and not only is John not welcome, but I'm going to put out anybody who would receive him. that's a pretty bold individual in that case. And he was certainly worthy of denunciation, and with unsparing terms, John did denounce him for his views, his practices. Anybody else?
When you look at John's mother also, she was a very strong person, wanting her sons to be up there.
Yeah. You'll remember that James and John were the ones that were where the mother of James and John made the request that her sons be given that place of precedence, the right and left hand of Jesus on his throne, which caused some problems with regard to the other disciples, as all of them sought to exalt themselves above the others. And that's an example of James and John not one of your shining moments with regard to their lives. But it just, again, is an indication that these are real individuals and not caricatures that we find in writing. Okay, the third point that we want to make note of here is the date of writing, and we've already made an allusion to it. Again, this is something that most agree upon. John's writings, at least the epistles as well as Revelation, were written at a fairly late time. Most conservative scholars believe that it was written about 90 A.D., Now, what you have, this is the reason, for example, of the different views with regard to the book of Revelation. When you look at the book of Revelation, it is obvious that the book was written during a time of great persecution. In fact, the purpose of the writing was to give comfort to the Christians at that time because they were being persecuted even to death. Well, there are two examples in that first century of such persecution. The first was the persecution that we see at the early date, the several decades following the death of Christ, the Jewish persecution. And then later on, about 94 to 96 A.D., the Emperor of Rome pronounced a persecution against the Christians. And it was a very strong persecution as well. So you'll hear people talking, for example, about the indifferent with the book of Revelation, and they'll ask you, are you one, someone who accepts the early date or the late date? Everybody wants to know that, because if you say that the book of Revelation was written at the early date, then the interpretation of who the symbols refer to and what's under consideration in some places in the book will differ than if you take the position that the book was written at a very late date. While the majority, I think, believe that the book of Revelation was the last book written in the New Testament, a very late date after the persecution began with regard to the Emperor Domitian, it's certainly by no means something that is held to by all. There are a lot of people who would say that it was written more along the lines of, I forget how the exact date, but just prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. There are those two particular positions taken. But this book, again, most agree was written in a late period of time, one of the last books written, maybe about 90 A.D. Now, the reason why they give the date about 90 A.D. would be that it preceded the beginnings of that second great time of persecution for Christians. Well, why would you think that it preceded that? Well, because there's not much or nothing actually in the text that would indicate that Christians were being persecuted here. In other words, the text doesn't deal with the reality of persecution or how to deal with persecution should it beset you. Now, that's not the purpose of the writing, so it may be that it's simply excluded for that reason. But because there is nothing said about persecution in 1 John, that would lead us to believe that perhaps the writing predated that second persecution by at least a few years. So, again, I'm just giving you the basic idea that that those who studied these and tried to ascertain dates of writing and such as to what they're thinking and why they think it. And I'll emphasize this as I've had time and again, I do not greatly care when it was written. In other words, it can help us a little bit, perhaps, with regard to noise and context and setting, but it's not something that we have to have unanimity or full understanding of the dates. If we had to know exactly when they were written and who they, you know, all of the things surrounding that, then God would have told us. And so we don't need to spend a great deal of time trying to nail that down. Yes, Mark?
Going to throw out there the same argument that you made about it being before the mission persecution is also an argument that's given for an early, approximately 68 AD writing before the destruction of Jerusalem. It's also that same argument because it is, there's no mentioning of the difficulties that came about that it was written prior to the destruction of Jerusalem as well. But you, again, that's one of those things that doesn't matter, A, and B, there's, at the time, John was in Asia, not in Israel, so it's kind of, I don't know why you would go that way, but I just thought it was interesting when I was reading that particular stance that they made that argument.
It's just different people have different views in that regard. And they'll look at certain parts of it and say, well, this gives credence to this one. It's the weight of evidence that leads most people to believe the treatment late then. But again, not of any great importance. And then finally, the persons that are addressed. And where in a lot of cases we can discuss that and there's something revealed as to who it was written to. I think that John is one of those examples of a general epistle, general in the sense it's timeless and the audience is broad. I don't know exactly to whom it was written. There's no individual or group that is addressed anywhere in the text, as was the case with Paul's writings, for example, often when he was writing to an individual like Timothy or Titus, or to a group, a congregation like Corinth, or to a group of churches like he did the churches of Galatia and Providence. In this particular case, we don't have assured certain knowledge of any particular individual or to whom it was initially addressed or sent. But it is a very general message. And I wrote down general and timeless. When we read the text, you're going to marvel at how applicable and how comforting that message is. It's every bit as appropriate to our time as any other. That direct and broad application will be helpful to us as we get into that study. And then you'll notice the last point in the verbs, the frequent call to avoid sin and worldliness is present in the book, which again may be an indication of a late date, because just as we have discussed with regard to 2 Peter, we'll talk about with regard to Jude, worldliness was a problem at this time. Now that's not to say that it couldn't have lends itself to that being specifically the time, because worldliness is always a problem. But I do want to remind you of the heretical Gnostics that were gaining some strength near the end of the New Testament canon, near the end of the first century, and remind you of the fact that these individuals were characterized by licentiousness in their lives, by individual immorality. And you'll notice there are a number of places in 1 John where he's, in fact, basically the concept of the book is fellowship with God and establishing how that fellowship is maintained. And there is that call to righteousness. There are a few verses in the first chapter we talk about how God is light and in him is no darkness at all. So we cannot have fellowship with the light if we walk in darkness. And that's certainly the opposite of what the Gnostics were claiming. Looking at that, what I tried to do with regard to the introductory page is find a text, a passage that is somewhat characteristic of the book. That's very difficult to do because so many things are covered in any book. But this is one. Notice in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 3. Beloved, we are children of God. It's not revealed what we shall be. We know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. This is, I think, a central theme of the book. that God is good, God is light, God is pure. As we acknowledge the goodness, lightness, purity of God, then we're going to see to emulate Him if indeed we are Christians. And there is that call to emulate and to walk in the light, to walk in purity, to be a righteous individual as well. And it is upon that basis that we have fellowship with Him. We'll talk about that a little bit more because it's not only in the third chapter, but it is perhaps the primary thought in the first chapter. So looking at the book in a nutshell, His desire was that His readers enjoy fellowship with God. And to that end, and He primarily does this in the first chapter, He explains how fellowship may be joined and maintained. That is based upon the imperative of love. And we'll talk about that in some detail. But when we talk about love, I think it coincides very much with the first chapter when it talks about light. Because those who love, and you have to love God, and you have to love your brethren. But He's the one that defines what love for God is. And He very clearly emphasizes the correlation between love and righteousness, or love and obedience. Love and keeping the commandments of God. And we have to allow Him to define what that love is, and He certainly does. So we'll look at that as we get into the actual study. Alright? Any questions, comments before we look at the discussion questions? And again, they will cover pretty much what we just talked about, so we'll go over them quickly and then get into the first chapter. Okay, first of all, how can we be certain that John's the author of the epistle? Can we look at it and say, I, John, wrote it?
Historical context.
Okay, the historical witness or testimony that establishes that so. And again, it's something that is widely recognized. Secondly, an important event in the Apostle John's life or ministry, and it may be something that's a bit different than what I noted, for example, in Acts chapter 8. Anything that stands out for any of you aside from that, if you wanted to make note of?
Matthew 17, it was on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Okay, the Mount of Transfiguration. Wouldn't that have been an absolutely amazing sight to behold? The witness, that's the witness of God on that occasion to the disciples. But the significance of that is something that if we aren't careful, we may miss. Because the three individuals that were on the mount at that time, or the two other than Christ, basically signified God's covenant with Israel. The lawgiver Moses, and then the preeminent prophet, which was Elijah. And so for Christ not only to be elevated in by God to this position where He was with these two individuals that held such an important place in the lives and the thinking and the minds of Jews, but to be elevated above them. And that's something that is very evident as the desire was expressed to make altars for the three. At that point in time, Moses and Elijah left the scene. They disappeared. And Jesus remained and was transfigured before them. And God's witness or testimony was, "This is my beloved Son. Hear Him." Not Moses. And that's the contrast. Then you don't listen to Moses and Elijah anymore. Now we have Jesus. Last of all, He sent His Son. And that must have been an amazing sight for those disciples. And John was one of the few that witnessed it. So it was, that's a, certainly a good example of that doctrine. Anybody else? Okay. Yes, Mark.
Matthew 4:21-22. The calling when he was called by Christ. Because if he had never, Christ hadn't happened to walk by that day, hadn't chosen him, you can start playing what if games all day long at that point. But that's the beginning of his ministry. That's when he was called.
Yeah. And to put it plainly, here Jesus says to them, you catch fish, come with me and you'll catch men. And I'll make you fishers of men. That's something that must have been a wonderful thing to recognize. Because we all look for significance in our lives. But we all, or many of us, are bound somewhat by what we might refer to as a plain or an average job or circumstances in our lives. All of us, to one extent or another, are rather nondescript. And in fact, it's interesting in the book of Ecclesiastes, the wise man talked about that. Individuals, even those who accomplish a great deal on earth, very soon they're forgotten. Another generation arises and forgets the ones who went before. I was thinking about this just the other day. I forget not exactly why, but we'll take as an example one presidential candidate a number of years ago, Michael Dukakis, and he is known primarily today for being a short guy with a funny name who rode on a tank with a funny hat on his head, and he ran for president, didn't make it, and that's what people remember him for. He accomplished much more than that. And you think about it with regard to Mitt Romney as well. He's a man that came very close to winning the presidency. And yet will go down as kind of a footnote in history because he didn't. And those are individuals that are very famous stand out above the rest of us in that regard. We live our lives, live and die, and the next generation rises. But in the midst of that, even though we may not be greatly known, if we have the opportunity to share the gospel with someone and save a soul, the significance of that is something that far exceeds anything that is accomplished by the leaders of our government or the people of the world. I may live the entirety of my life as a clerk at the local grocery store and not make much money and not many people know me, but if I can share the gospel with others and save some souls, it's been a wonderful life and a great accomplishment. And here he was given that opportunity to be one of the ambassadors of Christ. It was a significant thing, so that's a good point as well. Anybody else? Those are good examples. Yes, it is.
He stood at the feet of Jesus with the women at the cross. If I'm not mistaken, he's the only apostle, only disciple, beside the women, who was there when Jesus said, I'll behold your mother. He couldn't marry her, and she lived the rest of life with him.
Very good. Very good. That's another one for example.
Along that same line, you're talking about that you could preach other than save a soul, and that with Jesus, all of these miracles and things, you'd be doing greater things than this, and that is saving souls and preaching the gospel. It's even greater than all those things.
Good point. Good point. Question number three. Did John enjoy a special closeness to the Lord? And if so, how do we know that?
Yes.
Okay. I heard a yes. Go ahead.
Also, on the night that Jesus was betrayed, John laid his head on Jesus' breast with the cloak.
Okay. There's that indication certainly there at the supper.
I was going to mention that too, but also John always referred to himself as the disciple of Jesus.
Right.
Identified him as one of the three in the upper.
Yeah. There seemed to be, again, a number of occasions where there were three who were separated from the remainder and were witnesses of some special things and events in Jesus' life. So again, what we have is a snapshot. And we don't want from that to indicate that Jesus said, okay, you three are more important than anybody else. but there did seem to be a special affinity that Jesus had for John, something that's kind of evident. And again, John referred to himself in the gospel by name as being the disciple whom Jesus loved.
Someone suggested once about that I still haven't really reconciled, because either side kind of makes sense that there was that special bond, but someone has suggested that perhaps he wasn't referring to himself as the disciple Jesus loved to elevate himself above the others as much as it was that he would not name himself. And the focus was on Christ.
Right, yeah.
That Christ loved him.
I think both of them are the case. I really do. And again, when you consider even that statement, I don't think he was, even, let me put it this way. I think the idea was the concept of humility precluded him pronouncing himself in that. In other words, it's kind of a typical, it's not an atypical way of doing this, and they showed humility. But even in making that statement, it is not necessarily an indication that he was seeking to exalt himself above others. You know, in that statement, there may be that recognition, because he was, when he referred to as Son of Thunder, that there was much that that Jesus had to overcome in his character or person in order for him to love him. And so it was, again, an acknowledgement. It's just that, you know, even while we were unlovable, Christ loved us and God sent his Son to earth and expressed that love for us. So there may be something of that as well. But again, just as you look at the ministry of these men and what went on, it's obvious that John was among a few that were a bit closer, had more of an intimate relationship with Jesus than others. Yes?
Just an observation that I think hints at the closeness. We referred to a while ago, Jerry did, but the fact that when they were at the supper, John was sitting right next to Jesus. And that would have been a favorite spot that would have been by invitation only, I'm sure. But also that Peter asked John, motioned to John, and asked John to ask him, asked Jesus the question, who was it that was going to betray? So that indicates that there was, Peter didn't ask himself, he asked John to ask him, but there was a relationship.
Okay, good. Last two questions. For whom did he write his epistle? That's a general epistle that's relevant to us today. And the fifth question, calls for Christians to reject the world problems if necessary, and that's an allusion to our point with regard to Gnosticism. Although we would again emphasize that such worldliness exists in every generation, but there seemed to be a special problem at that time, and he was indeed addressing it. We will pick up in our discussion next week with the first chapter of the verse study, so if you will, make sure you have that handout available and answer the discussion questions. We'll get on. Thank you for your kind attention today.